Let's go straight into this with Colin Clark. Colin and Gillian Clark, their book, Postcolonial Trinidad, an Ethnographic Journal. I don't think I could introduce Colin Clark as the professor at Oxford, the man who's written all the major works on Indians in Trinidad. I don't know Gillian's work so much, but I've known Colin for many years, and obviously a very distinguished scholar from Oxford, and therefore always a pleasure to have at our conferences, since he's done, as I said, a lot of original research on Indians in Trinidad. But let me actually introduce Colin in a different way. Colin gave me my first academic job in 1983. Colin interviewed me and said, yes, boy, you could have the job. But I always thank Colin for giving me my first job. So I'm glad to do it on tape, and it'll be podcasted, right? He's obviously not responsible for my subsequent failures or misdemeanors, but I thank you, Colin. Anyway, it was terrific. So I'd like to call upon Colin and Gillian. I'm sorry, I don't know your CV as such, you know. I taught their daughter, which is my way of repaying you for giving me a job. She also came to Warwick University and now graduated, now married with two children, 10 and 8. We've really aged her. So Colin, please come and Gillian, tell us about your book, which is not out yet. It's out next week.
Thank you very much for the introduction, David, and thank you even more for inviting us to open the conference by talking about our book, which is called Postcolonial Trinidad, an Ethnographic Journal. It should have been published about 4 or 5 days ago, but 4 or 5 days ago I was contacted by Palgrave Macmillan to say they were very sorry. There had been a problem with shipping the books from New York, where the publishing was carried out. It will be available at the end of July, they assure me. The little adverts on the desks are in front of you, so you can read it through and see if you're interested in it. On the back there is information about how you might purchase it, I think at half price. So it's quite a good deal. Anyway, let me start off by I'm going to speak just for sort of 5 to 10 minutes about the book and how it came to be, how the journal came to be kept. And then we'll go into some readings from it, 4 readings, which we hope will give you some of the flavour of it. 2 of the readings at either end are interviews with individuals we had, which are reflective of both their life histories and their experiences of either indentureship or growing up in Trinidad. In the middle, we have 2 accounts, the first of a Hindu ceremony and the second one, a Muslim wedding. So we hope to give you some sort of sense of the diversity of our experiences in Trinidad based on our fieldwork there in 1964, 46 years ago. Of course, one of the important things about the journal is it is a reflection of Trinidad in its first couple of years of independence. So we've got a society, a colonial society which just moved into independence and has been beginning to crystallize out into an independent state. So it covers the second and third years of Trinidad and Tobago's independence and deals with a mini-state at that time of just over 800,000 population. The main reason for the research was, of course, that there was a great deal of concern both internationally and in Caribbean studies about Trinidad's segmented society, urban Creoles and rural East Indians, and that it might disintegrate through race-ethnic rivalry once independence was achieved in 1962. Of course, in the early 1960s, British Guyana had very tragically shown that racial-ethnic conflict could happen even in a British colony. So there are fears as to what would happen when colonial arbitration was no longer feasible. Anyway, as a recently married couple, we got a grant from the Research Institute for the Study of Man in New York. And early in 1964, Gillian and I set out for a week's library research and briefings from the director of RISM, Vera Rubin, and Lambros Komitas, her deputy director, in New York, eventually reaching Trinidad towards the end of January. We were to be there in 1964 until early September. Now, when I applied for the grant, I had anticipated that the project would draw on three sources of information. The first, perhaps not surprisingly for a geographer, was that we would acquire and analyze and map 1960 small area census data. So we would map out the social contours of our chosen research site. The town of San Fernando in the south of Trinidad, the second town with a population of about 40,000, one quarter of whom were East Indians. We realized at the outset that we would have to create a major data set to complement these materials, and that this data set would be based upon San Fernando's principal racial and religious groups, of which there were five, plus a control group of rural Indians drawn from the adjacent village of Debe. And devising the questionnaire and the sample frame and applying the questionnaire to almost 900 respondents using 10 trained assistants occupied most of the second half of our research period in San Fernando. The third source of information was the journal we kept more or less on a daily basis throughout our stay in Trinidad. Several people, knowing that the book is coming out, several Caribbeanists have said to me, you know, how do you manage to keep a journal on that kind of scale? And the answer is, I think, that we were both aware that that keeping a journal was going to be very important for us, both as a kind of repository of information on which one could draw in terms of writing up the research. But we were also very aware that many of the rituals we were seeing had not been recorded by, as it were, trained social scientists previously. And we were also aware that the questionnaire which we were going to carry out was going to be based upon precise questions, the very nature of which we did not at the outset know, which we were only going to come to know through keeping a journal and reflecting on it. Anyway, through a whole series of participant observation experiences in a multiplicity of rituals and events, and through a series of informal and semi-structured interviews carried out over a nine-month period, we began, bit by bit, day by day, to develop a detailed picture of life in San Fernando and in the East Indian villages in the surrounding Sugar Belt and beyond, recording scenes and conversations relevant to our research aims. The journal was crucial in identifying topics and issues that formed the basis of the questionnaire, and it became a repository of information and opinion that was drawn on by me in the background to my book, which was eventually published, called East Indians in a West Indian Town. But in fact, only eight extracts were lifted, as it were, verbatim from the journal and used in that book, largely, of course, because the journal ran to over 100,000 words, and it was impossible to incorporate so much of that material in an academic monograph with a restricted word limit. Hence the publication of this journal 46 years later as a separate but essentially parallel text that is parallel to my San Fernando book. Now, just a few words about the journal itself. The journal entries were made whenever there was evidence of a social scientific kind to report upon, important material which we thought was relevant to the project. The account was kept by Gillian and me, though Gillian made most of the entries in the first half of the text, and I recorded the bulk of the interviews in the second half. No tape recordings were used. We normally wrote the journal from memory during the early morning following the interview or event which we'd experienced and wished to have recorded. Most of my interviews with individuals in the second half of the project were preserved in detailed notes written at the time of the meeting with the permission of the respondent. We read one another's entries for completeness and accuracy and recall, and amended the document so that interviews and events which we'd shared reflected our joint participation. In fact, when you read the journey, you'll find that some of the longer entries, for example, have two parts, one which we started perhaps by Gillian, and then I would run on and conclude with items which I thought were important, which she hadn't recorded, and vice versa. This process of collaboration was more necessary and, of course, more feasible in the first half of the project when we were feeling our way and had more time to devote to the journal. The text of the journal does not, of course, argue its way analytically through an issue, as in a research paper. And in fact, I found it rather difficult in many ways, as when it came to editing it, to actually get hold of that sort of issue. Instead, each entry adds layers of meaning in the same way that an artist adds oil to a canvas. The narrative has been copied verbatim from our handwritten documents, kept in three notebooks, but cut by about 20% at the request of the publisher. Much of the material in the first half of the book, covering the months January to June, was written up in full at the time from memory or from notes kept during ceremonies or events we attended. The detailed interviews in the second half, covering July to September, were recorded on the spot in note form, as I've mentioned, and have been written as a narrative for this publication. In a few instances, sentences or paragraphs have been reordered to consolidate themes or to improve comprehension, and minor adjustments have been made to improve the style, avoid repetition, clarify meaning, and so on. To assist the reader, the text has been divided into three parts, which we've called Settling In, Taking Soundings, and Conversations. The language of the journal is, of course, standard English, with phrases from time to time in English Creole, or as Indo-Trinidadians might prefer it, Coolie English. Trinidad English Creole, unlike its Jamaican equivalent, which I've been struggling with for much of my research career, is spoken in a register that is readily accessible to standard English speakers once they've got their ear in, though our interviewees also use the odd Spanish or French Creole word that requires explanation, of course, in the footnotes. Spanish and French, of course, reflects Trinidad's Spanish colonial heritage and the role of French planters in the establishment of the slave sugar system in Trinidad before British colonialism and the introduction of Indian indenture. Most Trinidadian Creoles and Indians, other than members of the upper class, now, of course, speak English Creole or Coolie English all the time, but the older Indians who we encountered at the time of our fieldwork were frequently fluent in Bhojpuri, the language of Bihar and the adjacent parts of Uttar Pradesh, though this language was for long mistakenly treated as a variant of Hindi. Bhojpuri, or Urdu for Muslims, was widely used in conversations in Trinidad's rural villages in the 1960s and in Hindu and Muslim rituals in urban and rural areas. During Hindu and Muslim ceremonies, we would usually be given a running commentary in English, and we were especially well served by our two informants who crop up in at least one of the readings, Brahmadat Miraj and Hamsa Ram Samuj, both of whom were bilingual in English Creole and in Hindi. They became lifelong friends of ours, and the book is dedicated to the two of them as well as to other people who are invaluable in our research. Well, that's my background. I think what we'll do now is move into some readings of the text, just to give you some sense as to of what we were looking at and what we discovered, and to take us back to 1964. I'll give the first reading because I recorded it at the time, and then Gillian will join me in the readings. The first entry I'm going to read describes the first visit we made to a rural East Indian home, and we enter a different world from the one we've been living in. We've settled into Creole San Fernando. Most of our initial contacts are Creoles, either civil servants to whom we have some connections in the census office, or our landlady, for example, in San Fernando was Creole. But this invitation, which we had early in March, takes us to the rural area between Princestown and San Fernando and takes us into a world of indenture, Hinduism, the patrilocal extended family, and small-scale cultivation. And it's about Sarbjit Pundit, an ex-indentured labourer. At 2:15, we set off for the home of Sarbjit Pundit at Cedar Hill in the Princestown direction, which we found with some difficulty. The pundit was sitting at a table on the veranda of his small wooden house when we arrived. We were welcomed by him and his wife and were offered seats in their sitting room. The room was bare. The walls were of wood, as was the unpolished but carefully swept floor. The house was raised on low stilts, which must have been quite high at the back, where the ridge dropped down to the cane fields. The sitting room contained a settee, an easy chair, a rocking chair, and one or two upright dining chairs. The walls were covered with brightly covered pictures of Rama and Krishna, Ganesh, and calendars showing gods in similar scenes. The calendars were distributed by prominent East Indian firms. Frame pictures of religious importance for Hindus are sold in the arcade and on the street stalls in San Fernando. The sole piece of modern equipment was a radio, though we understood that the pundit's son has a motor car. I asked the pundit to tell me his name. He went into the adjoining bedroom and brought me his certificate to practice as a priest. It was dated 1937 and was signed by the then colonial secretary. Neither the pundit nor his wife can read or write English, though both can read Hindi and write Devanagari script. Sarbjit Pundit was born in a village about 30 miles south of Gorakhpur in the United Provinces of India. In 1911, when he was 21, Sarbjit went on a pilgrimage to Benares. He was met by a recruiting agent who promised that he would be able to make a lot of money if he signed up and went to Trinidad as an indentured labourer. He agreed, and when he landed in Trinidad, he was sent to the sugar plantation at Cedar Hill, where he worked in the cane for 4 years. Once his indentureship was over, Sarbjit started to work as a pundit and cultivated a plot of land at Panal, while continuing to live at Cedar Hill, growing coffee, cocoa and sugar. During this period, he married Sukhdaya, his wife. She lived in Panal with her parents until her wedding. Sukhdaya's father was born in India. His home was Benares, and he too, she claims, was tricked into enlisting for Trinidad with the tale that a fortune could be made there. Sarbjit Pundit's household comprises him and his wife, his son and pregnant daughter-in-law, and their 5 children. The daughter-in-law is fair-skinned, as is Sukhdaya, and quiet. Her children are beautiful, and her youngest son is clearly a favourite with his grandparents. Sarbjit was wearing loincloth and Indian shirt, dhoti and kurta, but no sacred thread, chaneo. His wife wore the head veil or orni. They are both strict vegetarians. It was interesting to see that despite their seemingly poor circumstances, they did have an Indian servant. She spoke Hindi too, and had tattoos in Devanagari on her forearm. Before leaving, we were each given sacred Hindu food, prasad, from their prayer room.
Can you hear me? Okay. Perhaps I could say a brief word, as I seem to be the mystery co-author, about myself. We married in 1962, after I'd just completed a degree in German at London University. I then did a teacher training year in Oxford, and with scant regard for any career I was going to have in the future, was very happy when this extraordinary opportunity arrived out of the blue to accompany Colin as his research assistant without any prior relevant academic training. But I soon got into the swing of things. And I have to say, it didn't do my career much good, but it was probably the most interesting and wonderful year of my life. So, we'd been on an evening visit to Princestown, which is just inland from San Fernando, and we're travelling back towards San Fernando with our 2 Hindu companions, Brahmadath Maharaj, Bram, and Hansaram Samuj. They were our principal informants during the research and became lifelong friends. This extract focuses on a visit we all made to the Hindu temple at Palmyra and the performance of a Ramayan satsang, or group performance of the Ramayana. It also includes the reactions of Bram and Hansa to what we witnessed. Thursday, the 19th of March. On our way back to San Fernando, we drove past the temple at Palmyra. As a reading in Hindi from the Ramayana was in progress, we decided to stop and see what was going on. The temple itself, erected around 1950 as a result of communal effort, stands somewhat lower than the road at the foot of a steep slope and is of a typically rural design. Wooden uprights support a vast galvanized roof, and the whole structure is enclosed within a waist-high, mud-covered wattle and daub wall. The mud and dung floor inside the body of the temple was meticulously tended by one of the village women. Below the roof were hung at ceiling height, criss-cross, line upon line of coloured paper friezes, all hand-cut. The temple consists of a large central space with mud floor in which the readings are held and where all services take place. In one corner, however, there stands a wooden shed, the mandir, or sacred part of the temple. This contains all the pictures and sculptured images of the gods, and of course the phallic stone or lingam. Here, ritual worship, arti, is performed, and nobody wearing leather footwear may enter. As in all Hindu temples, there were many flowers, though most of them were of plastic. The pundit and some of his helpers took us into the mandir in order to explain what was there and why. The pictures around the altar were of Ganesh, Shiva, and Hanuman, the latter clearly being the main god of that temple. Hanuman, the monkey god, a North Indian non-Aryan deity, is much loved by the lower castes. In a prominent position before the altar rose the lingam with the Mahadeo stone on top. Hansa told us that the Mahadeo stone will grow if constantly fed with water. In the main part of the building, near to where the pundit sat, a mud mountain topped with a yellow flag had been built. This is constructed every time there's a reading from the Ramayana, leading up to the Govardhan Puja. Around the mountain wound a spiral stairway of mud. Normally, a diya, or small clay lamp, is placed on top of the mountain. The officiating pundit sat near the mud mountain, on a yellow cloth. Around him, on pieces of cloth of different colours, sat four men who actually performed the reading and chanting from Tulsidas's Ramayana. They would read and chant one or two stanzas, slokas, in Hindi, and then the pundit added a few comments by way of explanation to those who were listening. Throughout the readings, chantings, and commentary, not a single word of English was spoken. In all, there were 17 people present, including the old pundit. Of these, 10 were women, all over the age of 30. Men and women sitting along the wall were segregated by sex. The readings from the Ramayana will take 1 year to complete. This group meets every Thursday evening and frequently sits all night listening to the Ramayana, which they love. Some of the women were so familiar with the text that they frequently joined in with the chanting. For them, the Ramayana is a guide to the good life. Both Bram and Hansa confessed that they feel happier with the Ramayana than with the Bhagavad Gita, as the former is easier to understand. Even so, Hansa compares the Ramayana with a forest. It can be hard to see the wood for the trees.
The next reading is a description of a Muslim wedding in Princestown and was written up on the 8th of June. It describes, concentrates particularly on the elaborate preparations for the wedding and then briefly with the wedding itself. On the on the evening of Saturday the 6th of June, we went to Princestown with Peter Dubay to see some of the preparations for a Muslim wedding to be held the next day. On the Sunday, Peter was going to take us to witness the marriage of the daughter of a childhood friend, a Muslim goldsmith called Tam. Tam's family had been one of the first in the street to own a bath, and the Dubay boys used to go there to wash as children. Wilma Dubay describes Tam's family as westernized Muslim. The wedding was between Tam's second daughter, aged about 21, and the son of an imam from Ayari village on the edge of the town. The couple had met and wanted to marry, and the union was approved by both sets of parents. The bride was a teacher and the young man a mechanic. However, despite the approval of both families, there had been considerable tension and conflict. For example, there's been an element of East-West conflict over the marriage ceremony, with Tam's family wanting a westernized wedding with music and a wedding cake, and the imam's family preferring a more strictly Muslim occasion. In the event, a compromise was reached. On the eve of the wedding, the groom's family held prayers at home. At the bride's home, villagers gathered to prepare the wedding food, but in accordance with the imam's wishes, there was no music to accompany them through the night. The parents had originally agreed that the wedding ceremony would take place inside the house, though Tam wanted it outside so where all could see. On the wedding day, the imam suddenly announced that he wanted a double wedding, that is, by proxy in the traditional Muslim manner. In such a case, the boy would remain outside the house and the girl inside, and they would then be married through a messenger. There was much argument between Tam and the imam, but Tam won this time, and it was agreed that the couple should be married on the settee in the front room. As we arrived on the Saturday evening, villagers were gathering at the bride's home. Some helped prepare food, others tried to prevent leaks developing in the bamboo and canvas tent in which chairs had already been set out. The main room in the house was elaborately decorated with sprays of fern and artificial vanda orchids on the walls. At one end stood a table displaying the wedding presents, vases, a dinner set, glass dishes, cutlery. In pride of place stood the wedding cake, three huge tiers set on a glass tray complete with plastic swans. A life-sized bunch of roses had been worked into the icing on one side of the bottom layer. The pièce de résistance on the top tier was a plastic archway with a distinctly Western bride and groom in the middle. The main preparations took place underneath the house. There, men of all shapes and sizes were singeing and chopping up dozens of pink chickens. Although a few women were helping or advising, this was largely the men's affair. Head teacher, one of the Dubay brothers, had the unenviable task of gutting the fowls. We looked on in amazement. Suddenly we were able to appreciate the value of communal effort at such a time. The bride's parents were paralysed into inactivity, while good friends ran the show. Under the house, too, stood the vast containers for boiling the rice and chicken and for mixing the flaky paratha roti. Roti making for weddings is almost a profession. It would seem that no chicken chopper would undertake to prepare roti. Instead, a serious, muscular young man arrived specially for the purpose. The mixing pot was set in a used motor car tyre to prevent it tipping, and then pound upon pound of flour and water were added to the pot and kneaded by hand into a soft dough. In all, 70 pounds of flour were used on this occasion. The preparation of the dough was arduous. It was tiring just to watch the roti maker, elbow deep in dough, blending and mixing it all by hand. Sweat poured from his face and arms, and like a professional wrestler, he had to retire at intervals to be dried off by a friend. The wedding on the Sunday was a modest affair. There were many Creole participants, as there had been Creole helpers the day before. Only one guest wore a sari. The bride was dressed in an elaborate white Western-style wedding dress with a veil, while the groom wore a dark suit, white shoes, and a white turban. When the groom's procession of cars arrived, they stopped outside the bride's home. The full meeting of the fathers, using the crossed hands Muslim greeting, then took place. The lineup of friends, all male, behind the bride's father was reminiscent of the Hindu milap. After entering the house, the groom sat on the settee in a hot, crowded room. Then the bride entered and sat on his left. The marriage ceremony was conducted in Urdu, all very short and simple. A few questions and prayers were followed by an explanation given in English. Finally, the bride and groom ate some sweetmeats and drank a soft drink from the same glass, the husband first. When the ceremony was over, the couple remained seated as friends came up and spoke to them. The groom gave his wife a wedding ring. Soft drinks, cake, and Indian sweets were handed round. Sometime later, the couple left for the groom's home, accompanied by many others. They would be formally received by the groom's parents, but were not going to live there. They have bought a new house in Diamond Vale and will probably honeymoon in Mayaro.
Our final extract is about Mrs. Ivy Gunness. Mrs. Ivy Gunness, Myrtle Ma, or simply Ma, was the mother of Myrtle Sammy and Robert Gunness, a teacher and GP respectively, both of whom appear later in this extract. Ma was married off at 16, widowed at 28, yet brought up five children to have professional careers. Her son-in-law, George Sammy, Myrtle's husband, was one of our informal advisers and later professor of food science at the University of the West Indies. Ma lived her life between Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism. But the Presbyterian Church, founded by Canadian missionaries in the mid-19th century and deeply involved in education throughout the Canadian, through the Canadian Mission Indian schools, was the key to her family's educational successes. Although she considers herself first and foremost Indian, the extract reveals some crucial friendships with black neighbours. Thursday, September 3rd. Mrs. Ivy Gunness, or Ma, was born in 1908 in Williamsville, opposite the railway station. But both her grandfathers had come to Trinidad from India as indentured workers. When Ma's father died, her eldest brother, Claudius Nearmath, head of Rock River CMI School, who owned land on the Maruga Road beyond Penal, took the family to live with him. Quote, "Indian people make a match for the girls," she said. And in 1924, at the age of 16, Claudius Nearmath arranged a marriage for her. She had no choice. Ma's husband, Mr. Gunness, had been brought from India at the age of 5 by his mother, an indentured labourer, whose husband had been lost in some violent dispute, and she and the children were, as Ma said, running away in the jungle, I suppose. She brought 5 children to Trinidad, of whom 3 were known to Myrtle Ma. The family was sent in 1883 to Petit Morne Estate on the site of Usine St. Madeleine, where the Rostong family were managers. Ma's future mother-in-law and her children were put in servants' quarters, not in the barracks, and were never worked in the fields. The Rostong family made sure that little Mr. Gunness had books and went to school. Eventually, Mrs. Rostong and her husband separated. She had unfortunately become mentally ill. While the other brothers followed the Rostongs and became Catholic, Ma's future husband, Mr. Gunness, became a Presbyterian at the age of 10 or 12. As a pupil teacher, he went to Naparima Training College, where he was taught by the famous Dr. Coffin and Dr. Scrimger. And eventually he became head teacher at Brothers CMI School and at Debe, where he served for 35 years. Ma's father was called Nearmath Ali, and he and his wife had a Muslim marriage. Both sides were relatively well-to-do, but Ma's mother did not like her in-laws, with whom she lived, and she used to run away from time to time. The Presbyterian, Reverend McRae, advised the troubled young couple to register their marriage, and they eventually became Christian without ever knowing much about Christianity. Ma's father was a teacher, cane farmer, and cocoa proprietor. In 1924, when he and Ma married, Mr. Gunness had 22 pupils in the Debe CMI school. After his death, 12 years and 5 children later, Ma left Debe and moved to Coffee Street in San Fernando. These were hard years for Ma. She continued with the cane farming started by her husband, sewed clothes, and sold in the market, where she was known by the honorary title of schoolmistress. Ma joined Susama Char Church in 1936 and became a great admirer of Reverend MacDonald, the long-serving minister. In the 1940s, Ma lived at the Papuri Road corner in Duncan Village, and when her daughter Myrtle married George Sammy, they lived with her. Then she moved back into Coffee Street, buying the land for her house in Westwood Street and building her home behind the Todd Street Mandir in 1959-60. Shortly after, George and Myrtle built their own house on an adjacent plot. When Ma's son Robert, who'd been studying medicine in England, wrote to his mother announcing his intention to marry Jean, his English girlfriend, Ma replied, telling him that if he persisted, he was never to come back to Trinidad. Robert replied, "I'm definitely going to marry Jean. You were the only reason why I wanted to return to Trinidad, and now I feel free to do otherwise." Ma retracted at once and asked him to come back. On Robert and Jean's arrival in Port of Spain as a newly married couple, Ma took 4 specially made heavy gold bangles down to the ship with her. She presented them to Jean and reminded Robert that he had married the only child of an English couple and had brought her thousands of miles away to Trinidad. If ever he ran around with any other women, there would be big trouble. There was trouble. Nowadays, mother and daughter-in-law are inseparable. Jean never makes a decision about herself or the children without consulting Ma. Ma relies heavily on Jean for financial support. Ma knows a bit about Hindu and Muslim customs, but not too much. She finds herself somewhere between Christianity, Hinduism, and Islam. She started to wear the Orni about 2 weeks before her marriage. "You must be married," she asserted. Ma feels strongly Indian. Quote, "I like my own Indian people. My heart goes out to them quicker than anyone else." She doesn't eat pork, but since childhood has eaten ham, insisting that the two are in no way linked. She continued, "Blacks look down on Indian people and call them coolie. She finds some black spongers, but so are Indians too." She said, "I have 1 or 2 very good black friends, and some of the cultured ones are very nice. I wouldn't like that intermarriage at all. Chinese and European are okay, but I couldn't stop it. I would not have too much to do with them. I'm proud to be a coolie. I have 1 or 2 black friends who are very good, but I just keep a little way away from them. I can't be like family with them, though they may have better qualities than my own Indians." She also has Chinese friends, but those that are really close to me are my own people. 8 days later in our diary, we record, "We spent our last night in Trinidad with George and Myrtle Sammy on the campus of the University of the West Indies at St. Augustine near Tunapuna, where George is now a lecturer in chemical engineering. We told them about the conversation we'd had with Myrtle Ma and her observation that she has a few black friends but would never regard them as family." Myrtle shook her head, smiled, and enlarged on this. "Whenever Ma is in any trouble, the person she turns to first of all is Mr. James, one of the few blacks in Debe where she had lived as the bride of the headmaster." Thank you.